BCFM 93.2. Bristol is our community.
Sorry. Exhaustion.
No. Drugs. Your pupils are contracted.
I don't take drugs.
Forced feeding them.
Why would they?
You tell me.
Mean you condescend to listen?
I listen, as long as what you're saying doesn't become too obviously phony, yes.
Find help somewhere else.
They told you to find it here, didn't they?
Leave what you like, it doesn't matter anymore. No. No, it does matter. This concerns the welfare of everybody in this village.
And welfare is our biggest consumer item, yes?
Joke about this if you can. Assassination.
Are you trying to organize or prevent one?
Prevent. They would have to take reprisals. Everybody would suffer.
All right, what can I do for you?
I've just told you I need your help in preventing an assassination.
They've heard. They are aware. And they don't need anyone's help.
They don't believe me.
No comment.
So much caution in a man like you, it seems so wrong.
Many times bitten, forever shy, but they are not shy. They love to listen.
You don't understand. My name, my number on a list.
Honors or deportation?
Jamming.
Jamming? Domestic science?
You learn about jamming one of these days. It's the most important ways of fighting back.
All right, enlighten me now.
No. I tell lies, remember? Sorry I ever bothered you.
Call in any time you like.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show, Friday Drive Time, with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. As two of their directors are jailed, can we trust French nuclear firm EDF to build a new nuclear power station at Hinkley? Yes, a criminal hacking conspiracy is exposed at EDF over in France, who are still pushing forward controversial plans to build a new nuclear power station at Hinkley Point. EDF were in court yesterday. And on the week youth unemployment set to reach 1 million, the government plans to make it even easier to sack people. What are your rights as a worker, and how long will those rights last? Will Stone's here with all the gen from the Avon Law Centre. And are our present drug policies working in the interests of organised criminals? We find out why they could be, and we zoom in on one of the least understood drugs, the powerful hallucinogenic LSD, with Danny Kushlick from Transform, a national drug policy charity based here in Bristol. But first, it's Will Stone from the Avon Law Centre. Hi, Will, and welcome to Drive Time.
Hi, Danny.
Now, in the week, a leaked report from 10 Downing Street has revealed Prime Minister David Cameron wants to make it even easier for employers to sack employees. So I think it's quite a good timing to have you in here talking about your employment's rights. So essentially, how do you know if you've actually got any rights as an employee?
Well, you probably need to go and get some legal advice. And that the Law Centre is well placed to do that.
Because at the moment, as I understand it, it's basically after a year of employment, then there are certain rights that kick in. But how do you actually know whether you've got those rights or not?
Well, there are certain rights that kick in after about 4 weeks, and the first of that is the right to a week's notice once you've been employed for 4 weeks. Immediate rights would be the right to a written statement of your terms and conditions. I think that comes in after 4 weeks as well, and also right to itemised pay statement, and that's it really.
So if I can imagine though, you may go and demand these rights, or not politely ask for those rights from your employer, and they may actually take that as a sign that maybe you're not the right person to employ.
It's very difficult in the first year because your employer can dismiss you without giving any reason. You would then, if you thought that you had been dismissed for exerting a statutory right, in other words, for demanding a written statement of your terms and conditions, you would have to prove that in an industrial tribunal. That might be very difficult to do.
Okay, so Martin, what are your thoughts about this? Going to just bring you in here, because I'm quite concerned that we're in a situation economically where there's more and more pressure on the small businesses particularly, and that there may actually be more people about to be sacked, and then there already are more people being sacked.
People who work in Citizens Advice have told me that in actual fact a lot more people are being sacked for disciplinary reasons because they don't want to play redundancy. So you get rid of people by disciplining them and getting rid of them, because then of course you don't have to pay them redundancy pay and so on. And so you're getting more and more people turning up at Citizen Advice Bureaus with grievances with their employers, because the employers want to get rid of them, but they use some kind of disciplinary matter to get rid of them so they avoid paying them any redundancy money.
Now, certainly it's a good idea to go and talk to a lawyer if it looks like you're about to be sacked or you just have been sacked, to know whether you've got any rights. What kind of advice would you give someone in that sort of situation, and what are the key things we need to know whether we've got a right to go to a tribunal or not?
Well, if you've been employed for over a year, you certainly have quite strong employment protection rights. That is the right not to be unfairly dismissed. Prior to that, there are certain other rights, like the simple rights that I've just explained. But you can get advice. You can look if you just need to know what your rights are. Actually, the DirectGov website is very good on having very simple explanations of basic employment rights. The national minimum wage, for example, those rates are all set up on the website. If people are concerned about national minimum wage issues, they can ring the national minimum wage helpline. They can do that in such a way that their case can be investigated anonymously by the Inland Revenue. That's quite a good service that I quite often refer people to, because they ring up, they're saying, look, I don't think I'm being paid enough here, but I don't want to do anything about it because I'm afraid I'll be sacked. Well, in those circumstances, they can report the matter to the Inland Revenue, who will investigate it without necessarily revealing the name of the informant.
Now, if you decide you want to go to an employment tribunal, is that going to cost you?
Not at the moment, but I do understand that the government are talking about introducing fees.
So at the moment it's covered by the legal aid, is it?
At the moment it's completely free. You can make a claim, there's no fee to pay. If you want legal representation, that's a little bit different. You may be able to get representation if you're a member of a union. Most unions have access to solicitors and will offer representation.
I think for a lot of people that's one of the main reasons to join a union, so if something does go wrong, you know there's a lawyer by your side.
When people ring me up, one of the first questions I always ask is, are you a member of a union? And unfortunately, one of the responses that I quite often get is, well, I've just joined now because I realise that I need help, but I haven't been a member long enough to get any help. So, yeah, it is a good idea to join a union, or you'll get cheap travel insurance at least, but if there are problems, you can always go to your union and they should be able to support you.
Now, what about when it actually comes down to it at the employment tribunal? What can you actually be, can your employer be told to give you the job back?
That very, very rarely happens. There is a power to do that. There is a power for reinstatement. That rarely happens. I think tribunals recognise that by the time you're sitting in front of a tribunal judge, the relationship is broken down so much that it's probably not a good idea to kind of repair the situation. But, I mean, you will get compensation. You will get compensation for the wages that you have lost, and also you can get compensation for injury to feelings in a discrimination claim.
So how much is that likely to be? I mean, maybe some percentage of a year's wages or something?
It kind of depends, really, on what your wage is. There is a cap on wages, which I think is currently around about £300 a week. You're not going to be walking away. Most people aren't going to be walking away with hundreds of thousands of pounds that you might read about in the papers. Most people would get an award of between £5,000 to £20,000, in my experience.
Oh, that's a fair amount. Okay, now on to Women's No Pay Day. That we missed that slightly. It was the 1st and 2nd of November. What is Women's No Pay Day?
That's right, that was the 1st of November is Women's No Pay Day. That was identified by an organisation called the Fawcett Society as being the date within the year from which women essentially on average are working for free. If you look at actually the gender pay gap, women get paid on average 17% less than men, and if you calculate that out over the year, the 1st of November is the point at which for the rest of the year women are technically working for free.
Okay, so well, not okay, but so what rights do women have particularly to get equal pay when they know that, for equivalent jobs in the same business or in an equivalent business, that men are getting paid more than they are?
Well, it only applies within the organisation that you're actually working for, so you can't go across organisations and compare pay. But the Equal Pay Act came into power in 1972, so it's been in power for nearly 40 years, and there's still this 17% pay gap across the whole country. One of the things that you do find in equal pay cases is that they tend to drag out. They drag on and on and on. I believe there's one particular equal pay claim that has been going through the tribunal system for perhaps nearly 15 years. That's where the union are trying to rationalise pay across government sectors and local authority sectors. But I mean, it ought to be a lot simpler, it ought to be a lot quicker than that. It's very difficult to get the evidence as well. You need to show that your job is of equal value. It's the same job, essentially. And there have been cases where, with the fragmentation that you get in local authorities these days, two people doing exactly the same job but in slightly different sectors, the courts have said no, that is not the same job because it's in a slightly different sector of the local authority or the organisation that you're looking at.
So is it still the case that men have the whip hand in company boards and when deciding on pay?
That seems to be the case. One difficulty that there is that there's no transparency at the moment. Now, one of the things the Fawcett Society have been asking for, and is in fact in the Equality Act, which was brought out last year, is to have a transparency, to have a kind of, for companies to publish information showing what the differentials between men and women are in pay. The coalition government have shelved plans to bring that into effect. I think initially it was going to come into effect next year in 2012. We're not sure when that's going to come in, if at all, now.
Okay, what about the Equality Act? What does that require an employer to do?
Well, the Equality Act brings together all the various discrimination, anti-discrimination acts that have been in force since 1975, when I think the first one, the Race Relations Act, came in to power. So now, rather than having about 20 different pieces of legislation, it's all, you've got one, the Equality Act, which deals with discrimination on the grounds of sex, which deals with discrimination on the grounds of race, sexual orientation, age, and of course we've got the more recent anti-discrimination legislation such as religion and belief.
Now it must be really, really difficult to actually prove any case like that. I mean, it's okay with what we were talking about previously with women and men. If they both got the same job description and they're being paid different amounts, it's pretty obvious. But with some of those things you've just mentioned, like racial discrimination, you know what employers are like? They're quite crafty at giving a reason why they've discriminated and coming up with some sort of, you know, maybe even a fake rational reason why they've done that.
Well, that's right. What the legislation allows and what the court has to look at is for the employers simply to give an adequate, credible explanation for the activities that are being complained of. However, it is recognised that, as you say, that discrimination is incredibly difficult to prove. And so there is a procedure that's contained in the Equality Act called the Question and Answers Procedure, where you're entitled, an employee or any person who feels that they've been discriminated against by anybody, is entitled to send a list of questions to that person. And if the answers are evasive, or if answers come back which just don't stack up, or if there's no answer at all, then that can be used as evidence in itself that the behaviour complained of must be discriminatory.
Now, what about agency workers? Because that surely, I mean, they get treated very badly. Is there any comeback for them?
agency work is a minefield, and it's a minefield because agency workers are not employees, so a lot of the legislation around protecting employees' rights just doesn't apply to agency workers. They're regarded as workers. The Anti-Discrimination Equality Act does apply to them, but other employment protection legislation, such as the unfair dismissal procedures, don't apply to agency workers. There are new regulations that came into power at the beginning of last month, when they came into power on the 1st of October, the agency workers regulations, which seek to try and redress that balance a little bit. But they do only apply to very certain sectors of agency workers, and not to agency workers as probably most people who are doing temporary work would see it.
Now, one of the stories in the Mail a couple of days ago said that there's been a leak. This is what I started off this piece with. A furious behind-the-scenes row has broken out in the coalition over proposals to end the employment tribunal bonanza, the Daily Mail calls it, costing British firms £1 billion a year. Now, a blueprint was drawn up from the Prime Minister's office. It would allow companies to dismiss staff more easily in exchange for compensation based on how long they've been employed. Don't you think this is actually quite a good thing, Will, in that you know how much you would be entitled to when you're dismissed, and you would actually get a lump sum and you wouldn't have to go to court?
Well, that kind of happens already, actually. I mean, that does surprise me, because it does sort of happen already under the employment legislation. There's a procedure called the compromise agreement procedure, where behind the scenes a confidential document can be drawn up letting employees go with what's called severance pay. But these tend to be used, and tend mainly to be used with higher paid jobs, with people working in the higher market, where there are confidential issues that need to be protected.
But what about this argument that the government are using here? They're saying, essentially, that business is in a really tough state at the moment. They're finding it difficult to borrow from banks, and the last thing they need is to be, I suppose, stopped from sacking people when it's necessary for the survival of the business.
People can sack people when it's necessary for the survival of the business, but they just have to show that that is the real reason. You can sack somebody if you need to reorganise your business, and you have to make them redundant. You have to give them entitlement to redundancy pay in the first year of employment. If you really don't think it's working out, you can dismiss somebody without giving any reason whatsoever. There isn't really any reason to give employers more rights to dismiss people. Now, one of the things that's also been talked about is extending the unfair dismissal time limit from 1 year, which it currently is, to 2 years. At some point in the recent past, it was 6 months. Prior to that, it was a year, it was 2 years, and it keeps going back and forwards. There's no evidence has shown that changing that time limit or making it longer makes any difference whatsoever to the amount of claims.
Because you do often find the tribunal. You do often find, don't you, that people get sacked just before they're coming up to this where their statutory rights start to kick in.
Yes, and there's nothing you can do about that.
That just extends that period for employers. It's rather nice. That was like the employers have been doing a bit of lobbying. Anyway, can you just tell us whereabouts the Avon and Bristol Law Centre is, Will, and how do you operate? Is it kind of drop-in?
Avon and Bristol Law Centre is in Stokes Croft, we can only see people by appointment, but they can ring our advice lines. We can make appointments with them over the telephone. The best thing to do really is to look at our website, which is www.ablc.org.uk, so ablc.org.uk, and all the information about how you can contact an advisor is on there.
And what's your phone number, and when is your front door open so people can come in and maybe book in person?
We're essentially open from 10 o'clock to 4 o'clock, although we have an hour where we're not open for lunch, from Monday to Friday. We're closed on Wednesday and Friday afternoons. Our telephone number is 0117 924 8662.
Will Stone from Avon and Bristol Law Centre at the bottom of Stokes Croft, thanks very much for joining us here on Drive Time. Now we're going to have a bit of music, and after that, Friends of the Earth, and let's have a look at the corrupt practices of these people who want to build a nuclear power station just downwind of Bristol.
Freeze! I'm my banker. Put your hands in the air. Give me all your money.
This is the story of my banker, the meanest cat from old Chicago town. We'll be right back.
Boney M there with Mar Baker. Now, we heard about fracking from Mike Birkin at Southwest Friends of the Earth for the first time earlier this year. Now, evidence has come to light that this controversial technique of pumping toxic chemicals into the Earth's substrata can actually help release new supplies of gas, which is rather nice, but it also has contributed, we hear, to two recent minor earthquakes around the Blackpool area where it's being tried out. Mike Birkin joins me again now. Hi, Mike. Welcome to Drive Time.
Hello, Tony.
Now, can you just take us right from the start? What is fracking?
It's an unconventional method of getting gas out of the ground. Basically, the gas is trapped in between layers of rock, and the exploiters drill down into the rock and use, under high pressure, they inject sand, water and chemicals, which pries open the rock and releases the gas, which they then pump up to the surface.
Now, those chemicals can also filter into the water table, and that's rather dangerous. So how the hell are they getting away with this?
That is one of the concerns. At present, there is no commercial scale fracking here in the UK. There's just been the sort of exploratory wells which have been in the Blackpool area, and which, as you say, were implicated in the two small earthquakes that were felt in that region in the summer. But other than that, the technology hasn't been used here in the UK. In the States, it's been very widely developed over the last decade, and there have been a lot of problems. And in fact, what happened there was that the Bush administration conveniently shelved a whole raft of water protection laws in order to allow the exploitation companies to get in and get the gas out.
Now, I hate to say it, but we seem to follow America in these disastrous policies. What's the future for fracking in Britain, though? Do you think it's actually going to expand, or is someone going to actually come to their senses and realise that it's a bonkers idea and stop it right now?
I think it's been very much the developers have really talked up the scale of the find that they've made in Lancashire, and that's been questioned by British Geological Society, who say they think it's unlikely that there really is that much gas to be exploited. But the government at the moment, driven by concerns around energy security, is looking favourably on it, and they say it would be well regulated. We're very concerned by these kinds of things. It tends to be the case that by the time you've found out what the problems are, it's too late and the industry is already entrenched, and the problems are then with you for decades to come. We're very concerned about the potential for gas shale exploitation on Mendip, because Mendip is the aquifer for Bristol and the region. It's where we get our water from. It's also where the Bath Hot Springs come from.
Well, it was a little bit of common sense kicked in recently, wasn't there, when someone decided they wanted to do a massive asbestos dump down there, and then eventually, you know, some common sense came along and they decided not to.
There was a failure there by the can't remember whether it's on the part of the local authority to require the developer to do the proper environmental impact studies before they accepted the planning application. So they've had to go back and reject that. I don't know whether the application's coming back again.
Okay, on to the big story for this week, and that is I noticed that EDF, who are planning to build this new nuclear power station at Hinkley, were in court yesterday in France and have ended up with two of their directors now in jail for 3 years. So let's have a listen to a report from Tom Clark, which went out last night on Channel 4 News.
It's the world's largest operator of nuclear reactors, not just in France, but in Britain, where it has more than 5 million energy customers. The conspiracy began here at a cafe in Place Saint-Augustin. The court heard how in 2005, former French intelligence officer Thierry Laureau, head of Paris-based security company Cargus Consultant, arranged a meeting between computer hacker Alain Quiraud and the then director of security at EDF. The computer hacker told investigators that at the meeting at the cafe, he was directly asked to help gain access to Greenpeace's computers. He was subsequently sent a list of email addresses and keywords to help target his attack. He even described how he used the back of a napkin to draw out how a Trojan horse virus would be used to breach security systems and get access to confidential documents. Placed on the computer of a senior Greenpeace campaigner at their Paris headquarters, the Trojan horse allowed the hacker to log individual keystrokes. That gave him access to passwords, through them, emails and confidential documents. The hacked campaigner was working on EDF's new nuclear plant design, the EPR. It's facing cost overruns and delays where it's being built in Normandy. The same design is due to be built in the UK. The campaigner is now a member of the European Parliament.
Now it's not only an industrial bankrupt, it's not only a financial bankrupt, but it's also a moral bankrupt.
All were handed jail sentences of up to 3 years for their part in the hacking. During the trial, it also emerged Cargus drew up a 100-page report on Greenpeace UK for EDF. Given EDF's key role in Britain's future energy supply, we asked the Department of Energy and Climate Change for a response to the judgment. They declined to comment. So too did EDF. Its lawyer told us today it would appeal the judgment. Tom Clark, Channel 4 News in Paris.
And that was yesterday's report, Mike. What do you make of this? Because it's pretty scary. If EDF are prepared to be committing crimes to illegally spy on those who are actually simply just doing their, what their, should be their right, which is researching their failures. I mean, in this case, it was all to do with massive cost overruns and delays, so they weren't actually fulfilling their promises over in France.
Yeah, it's of course it's very worrying for us here in Bristol and Somerset, as EDF have just lodged their application for a massive power station, new nuclear power station at Hinkley Point, and opposition to that will be organising and I'm sure you're really growing very rapidly over the next few months. And if we're sort of faced with an opponent that is prepared to use those unscrupulous and illegal tactics to try and wrong foot their opposition, then I think that's something we have every right to be very concerned about.
But how can we, after this, trust anything they say? If they're prepared to actually, I mean, they've been fined €1.5 million euros, which I would imagine, if they're sitting there looking, well, €1.5 million euros compared to the massive billions of debt we've got is virtually nothing. So it's not exactly going to hurt them.
No, it isn't. And I think various times in my life I have learnt the lesson that you don't trust what the nuclear industry tell you, and to me this is it's just another piece of evidence that shows how in the commercial sector to be an environmental activist is widely regarded as being sort of subversive or even a criminal activity in its own right, so that we're sort of seen as fair targets for all sorts of unscrupulous tactics.
Yeah, one recent news story said the Bristol Evening Post triumphed at EDF's Energy South West Media Awards. A record 7 wins saw the Bristol Evening Post triumph at the EDF Energy South West Media Awards 2011. The ceremony was held at the Energy Skills Centre. So this is a little bit concerning, isn't it? Well, EDF are then going around delivering awards to our local newspaper here. I'm imagining that they're trying to sort of cosy up to them.
Well, yeah, I mean, EDF and other large companies, of course, have a reputation and a track record for trying to ingratiate themselves in the public eye by appearing to sponsor prestigious awards or sponsor charities. Or I noticed the latest promotion for EDF is they're giving away tickets to 2012 Olympics, or you can compete for them. But I think actually the majority of people who pay their electricity bills to EDF don't take such a charitable view of them. EDF are now posting record profits. They announced their latest profits just yesterday, which again have risen very sharply. They're paying massive dividends to their directors and shareholders, while people in the UK who are their customers are really struggling to make ends meet to pay their energy bills.
Well, Dan Pritchard, EDF, hopefully he's not one of these directors who was is now in jail, but he's saying he was EDF's Energy's regional media manager. He's probably not a major director. He's one slightly down the food chain in EDF. He says, well done to the Bristol Evening Post. They've had a fantastic year, and it's clearly been a team effort across all departments. As the judges said, this was a really strong newspaper that's had a great year with bullish front pages and news, but very still hard news, but still very local. So this is one of the things that bothers me, Mike, about the it seems that EDF are quite prepared to to ingratiate themselves with the various elements that there are in the local region which are going to give them their power station. And this in a way is a sort of another tack to what's been going on covertly here.
Yes, it is worrying in terms of the independence of journalism, isn't it? When you see a major company that ought to be, in a sense, one of the, or more open to scrutiny, than most other organisations in the region, yet actually sort of currying favour with the newspaper.
So you said it in the past that you've had reason to doubt the word of the nuclear industry. In what way have you, where have you come across this kind of thing before?
Well, I think it's been endemic, my concern of the nuclear industry dates right back to the 1970s and 80s. In the 80s, they were proposing to build nuclear power stations in Cornwall. Three sites were identified there. I was a resident of Cornwall at the time, and that's when I first kind of really got to know the industry. And we met some very reasonable people who had been working for the industry all their lives and assured us, how well motivated they were, and they were professional people, and the industry was well regulated, and they put across a very convincing argument. It now transpires, now the records have come to light at the very same time as these people were giving this reassuring message in Cornwall, the same industry up in the far north of Scotland at the Dounreay reactor, where they thought they were safely out of the public gaze. They were just chucking unlicensed, unregulated amounts of nuclear waste down a hole in the ground to the extent that it actually fizzed and exploded. There was so much nuclear material in there that it actually caused a criticality accident.
So Martin, where's all this going? Are we going to get a power station here or not from these people? And can we trust them?
Well, I've always said that the economics of nuclear power don't add up. And without the state picking up the tab, particularly for the insurance, if you think about the insurance costs, the real market insurance costs after Fukushima of running nuclear power stations, without state support, it's not viable. And of course, in France, because they've supported it for many, many years, they then want to sell it on just to cut their own losses. So they're in the position of trying to push nuclear power on other people to try and make sure that they make up for all the money they've put in that direction.
So, Mike, tell us a bit about Friends of the Earth Southwest. Are you having meetings in and around the city over the next few months? And how do people get in touch with you?
Yep. Get in touch with us at bristolfo.org.uk. I think we're not having our meeting in December because our venue is too popular for Christmas events, so we'll be meeting again in January. We've got a series of public meetings planned for early in the year, but we'll be posting those on the website. You can also subscribe to a list, Bristol Environment, where you get details sent to you by email on a regular basis.
And do you have a telephone?
Yep, my number's 0117 942 0128. Excuse me, 942 0128.
Mike Burke here from Southwest Friends of the Earth. Thanks very much for joining us on Drive Time this evening.
The Adventures of Stevie V there with Dirty Cash, something that EDF Energy and many of those other big corporations are after. Anyway, one of the fundamental disagreements that splits the coalition government at the moment is drugs policy. Conservatives want to continue with the current arrangements, while Lib Dems have recently reaffirmed that they want to decriminalise drugs. The increase in youth unemployment means that young people are increasingly tempted into joining organised crime and drug dealing gangs to make a living. Well, we're lucky enough to have a national drug policy charity based here in Bristol, and the director is with me now, Danny Kushnick. Hi, Danny. Welcome to Drive Time.
Good evening.
Now, what is the problem, Danny, with drugs? Why have you decided that, is there something in your life that you want to actually change government policy?
Well, it's twofold. I was and am a user of illegal drugs, and I find it abhorrent that the state can intervene in my life. But more importantly, the impact of criminalisation on the most marginalised and deprived communities, from Mexico to Afghanistan, West Africa, Colombia, is overwhelmingly negative, counterproductive, and lethal for some of the most poor people on earth.
Now, I've seen back in one of those old B movies, Key Largo, where you've actually got a situation of prohibition in the United States. That's when it's filmed, and one of the sort of bad guys in the film is coming along, and he's actually saying, actually, organized crime loves prohibition. It loves prohibition. So is this something which I think, does it translate into the current drugs market in Bristol and other parts of Britain?
It doesn't need to be translated at all. It's literally the same. If you prohibit any demand-led commodity trade, all you do is you gift the trade to organised crime. It's happened since time immemorial. We know that unless you can stifle the demand completely, you will have a trade and you will have a production. And what's happened with this contemporary one is, which was begun 50 years ago, 1961 was the UN single convention that most UN member states signed up to, that put in place a prohibition, a blanket prohibition, on the non-medical use of cannabis, opium and coca-based products. And what it did 50 years later, well, basically 30 years later, by then, it had created an opportunity for gangsters. It was a gangster's charter all over the world, and now is the second largest money earner for organised crime, to the tune of $320 billion every year. It competes with oil, wheat and arms, and it's a trade that is enjoyed and used to deal with social discomfort by 250 million people worldwide. It's not a small market, and it's one that would be vastly better managed by states than gifted to organised criminals.
But we can't have a situation where anyone can just go and buy some heroin, surely.
Well, it won't be like that. The frameworks are all in place for this. We have a system where throughout the world, and certainly in the UK, one of the things we do is we grow poppy. In answer to a PQ, parliamentary question recently, it turns out that the UK grows 8,500 hectares of opium. It's the same stuff they grow in southern Afghanistan, but it doesn't have any of the problems associated with it. It's not taxed by the Taliban. And we currently prescribe heroin to maybe 500 dependent users in the UK. But it's available through prescription. The other ways of doing it are through pharmacy dispensing and through licensed retail. Now, we wouldn't allow a five-year-old to walk into a pub and neck a double scotch. It would just be socially unacceptable and, in fact, illegal. So you can put controls on that currently aren't available in the illegal market. So there's a kind of pretense that we have where we're protecting vulnerable people from drugs by putting in place a prohibition. But what you actually do is create the freest market on earth. And if you want to see capitalism red in tooth and claw, it's the prohibited market, the so-called controlled drug market, which is totally out of control. Profit margins of 2 to 3,000%. In terms of comparing that with luxury goods, oil, any other commodity on earth, these are profit margins that you would kill for. And guess what? They do. 30,000, 40,000, maybe 50,000 people have died in Mexico in turf wars in the last 4 years. So what you're looking at is really the freest market on earth, and one that needs to be, again, brought back within state control.
Martin, what do you make of this as an international problem?
Well, I think it's a very key problem. The UN report on drugs and crime a couple of years ago pointed out that when the banks wobbled in 2008, all of the dirty money that had been hanging around for ages was sucked into the system in one go. So we've actually got a situation where the illegal drugs market underpins the financial sector. And there's no doubt about this. Well, Javier Bank in the US was caught out working with the drug cartels, because the drug cartels, of course, like all businesses, need banking services. And banks, when they're on their uppers, are quite happy to give them those services. Also, of course, what's been going on, if you think about the Iran-Contra affair in the 1980s, Colonel Oliver North, the investigations by Senator Kerry's committee into all of that, uncovered that basically the CIA were involved with Adolfo Calero and the Contra rebels in Nicaragua in bringing massive amounts of cocaine into the United States via MENA Air Base in Arkansas and other places. And people can just look this up. It's all on the record. Mike Rupert, who is the head of the Los Angeles Anti-Narcotics Squad, he uncovered that the CIA were bringing all the cocaine into Los Angeles in that period. And there's a famous video which you can find on the internet of him challenging John Deutsch, the deputy director of the CIA, at a mass meeting in South Central Los Angeles High School, which is absolutely full of black parents who are screaming with anger, because it's becoming quite clear that the intelligence services are mixed up in the drugs.
Well, that's the American intelligence services, and you can see why maybe in the United States some of the chiefs of the intelligence services
MI6
don't want
to appear
in public.
The CIA are absolutely in cahoots. Now, this is one of the things that's going to make it difficult for rationality to prevail, because in Colombia, for example, Auto Unidos Defensas de Colombia, the right-wing paramilitaries, are the biggest drug dealers in the country. Uribe, who was the former president, was named by the DEA as one of the top drug dealers in the country, but these are our allies. Wali Karzai, who was assassinated a few months ago in Afghanistan, named by the DEA as the biggest drug dealer in the country, he's our ally, he was on the CIA payroll. That's what the boys are dying for in Helmand Province, to protect the drugs trade. This has all gone way too far. Something has got to be done about it. It's a real problem. And if the economy crashes, you can see that the drugs trade will be enormously expanded as a result of this. And we've got all the social consequences.
I see you nodding there, Danny. But to bring this back down to a sort of more of a local level, what's the difference between some of these drugs? I mean, we hear the term drugs used as a very blanket expression. Mm. You mentioned there, of course, about the idea of giving large amounts of spirits to children, alcohol. Do you think it actually helps to use the term drugs, or should we be dividing them down into the individual things like crack, cocaine, heroin, ketamine, LSD?
Well, the first thing you've got to do is level the playing field. So the term drugs is useful to the extent that we include pharmaceuticals, alcohol and tobacco in there. The Portman Group and the who operate on a lobby group on behalf of the alcohol industry and the tobacco industry are very keen to make sure that their products are never, ever described as drugs. So drugs are dirty and bad and evil. Literally, and people will use those words, politicians especially, and people who sell them are pushers, whereas the person that you go and buy your tobacco off is a tobacconist, and the person that you buy your alcohol off is a publican or a barmaid. One thing that we need to do if we use the term drugs is to include all drugs in there, and then to look at the disparity between the way one lot dealt with compared with the other lot. So yeah, one lot are prohibited and the other one are overwhelmingly allowed by states. That they basically give corporate bodies free rein to do whatever the hell they want with them. There's no minimum alcohol pricing, there's no ingredients listing, there's no health warnings on alcohol products. So you have this completely dissonant attitude. But yes, we need to break them down as well, because different drugs have different effects.
I mean, surely there's a bit of an incentive for the Conservatives right now to be doing this, because they'd be raking in quite a lot more in tax, wouldn't they?
Well, the Tories...
Duty, sorry.
The Tories are split. And it's really interesting that a lot of the libertarian minded Tories would love to grab this. And you know, the Tea Party split on this as well, or maybe even lined up behind it, but just can't actually speak its mind. What you're looking at here is a policy change that is supported across an incredibly broad political spectrum. So legalization is supported by the Libertarian Party. It's supported by Ron Paul and Gary Johnson in the US. It's supported by the Communist Party of Great Britain, by the Socialist Workers Party. It's an extraordinary heady mix of arch libertarians and socialists. There's a It's and what's important is to draw out the key elements of what's going on here, to look at what's really being called for, because there is a difference between those people who are looking just to grab some bucks out of the trade at a time of economic collapse. And let's not forget that one of the big reasons why alcohol was re-legalized in 1932-33 in the US was because the Treasury was desperately in need of alcohol revenue. They were heading into a depression, and the main force behind that was the need to raise money. And interestingly, we're right in the middle of one now. We also have the enormous corruption that goes on, particularly and that is so evident in places like Mexico, that is really going to drive change. It won't happen because politicians suddenly become enlightened along a liberal line and really need to champion the cause of social justice for marginalised and deprived people around the world. It's going to be the money. Money talks. And what you have is this interesting balance where there are enormous vested interests in maintaining the status quo. But gradually you're going to see a tip where actually the costs of maintaining the current policy are so high, politically and economically, that people are going to want to shift to a regulatory
regime.
We may
even be there, it's just that the political forces are in denial about it. One of the newer drugs which is around, which I think for a lot of people, they're not really quite sure what it is, what its effects are, is ketamine. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Well, ketamine is often described in the media as the horse tranquilizer. So you'll always hear it as the horse tranquilizer. It's technically an emotional dissociative, which is why it is used in veterinary anesthesia, because particularly for small animals, not actually horses, but although it is used on horses, it's used for trauma in animals because it's less dangerous. It doesn't suppress the central nervous system. It's also used in trauma in humans. I remember an episode of Casualty where a guy fell on a pitchfork. It was some ludicrous accident involving him falling off a ladder, and he was given ketamine. So it is used medicinally, but it provides an out-of-body experience for users, and it's used very, very widely now. It's pretty cheap, and your bangs for bucks are pretty good. It's relatively safe. And I say that, I caveat that with the fact that all drugs involve taking some kind of risk when you use them, but it doesn't have, in the way that heroin does, for instance, a small gap between the active dose and the overdose, which is the real problem with heroin. Ketamine doesn't have
Martin, that. You were recently saying that ketamine's not cool.
Well, I mean, I've just seen people using it at parties and rolling around on the floor and thinking, no, I'd rather be dancing, but there you go. But that's a matter for personal choice.
Danny, why is it people will use drugs? I mean, can't we just go through our lives without drugs? Surely fresh air is good for us.
It is. It is. And so are drugs good for people, too. They're also a nightmare for people. Some of the, you know, one person can have a really awful experience with a drug at one point in their life and a really good one at another.
This is actually, I think, one of the best reasons for potentially to legalise drugs or to decriminalise them is that actually then there would be some kind of regulation over the quality. At the moment, there's none.
That's absolutely right. The fact is, the reality is that people use drugs, 250 million of them worldwide, and you need to manage the production and supply of those things. But basically, people use drugs for two very basic reasons. One is to feel good, and the other is to stop feeling bad. The former group we would call users, the latter we would call misusers, problematic users, dependent users or addicts. And they are two very different groups of people, and one of them is much smaller than the other one, and it's the dependent population that is the much smaller group. So that when people talk about their fears around these the prohibited drugs, they need to recognise that the vast, vast, vast majority of people who use drugs do not experience significant problems with them.
Now, one
the
of
other
the most
do need to be helped.
One of the most peculiar of all these drugs is LSD, which was discovered in the Second World War. What's the effects of that?
Well, LSD was synthesised in a lab, so it doesn't exist naturally, but there are drugs that are very similar. So whilst it does have a particular effect, it's an incredibly powerful, it comes in the group of drugs called psychedelics. So it's in that group containing mescaline, DMT, And some of those drugs are naturally occurring in cactuses and fungi.
But
mushrooms.
You know, don't you agree that drugs like that should be really quite strictly controlled because it could have a very devastating effect on someone?
But all drugs need to be really well controlled. This is the point. The point is that because drugs can potentially be misused, that's why they need to be legalized and regulated. It's not because they're safe, it's because they're dangerous. And whilst at the same time as saying that, it's really, really important that people know that the reason why people use drugs like LSD, like magic mushrooms, is because they also have incredibly powerful positive experiences using them.
Well, it's funny you should say that, because as our last little clip, we're going to have a listen to the guy that actually, the chemist that discovered LSD, Albert Hofmann. He made it clear that used properly, the drug could be a great benefit to mankind.
The most important what I gained from my LSD experience was the insight that which commonly is believed to be ethereality is not something fixed but rather ambiguous. I experienced another reality under LSD, and before I had always thought there is only one reality, a true reality, but then I realized there are other dimensions of reality.
I realized there are other dimensions of reality. That was Albert Hofmann, the chemist in Switzerland in the Second World, during the Second World War, who discovered it. Now, Danny, can you just tell us finally whereabouts we can find your information on the internet about the Transform campaign and the charity?
The easiest way to find Transform Drug Policy Foundation is to type Transform into your proprietary search engine.
Not necessarily Google.
Not necessarily Google, and it will pop up number one, or okay, number two, under the medical group.
And do you have a phone number?
We do, with Bristol, 0117-325-0295.
Well, that's all the serious talk out of the way for tonight, because after the Sky News at 7, Friday night is music night. Thanks very much to our guest in the first hour, editor of Occupy Bristol's Daily News Digest, Polly Winch, and all our guests in the second hour. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you an enjoyable weekend. And we're on thisweek.org.uk.